Welcome back to The Real Big Show. I'm your host, Michael Petrelli. This week, we are joined by two guys I really want to go away from right now. Jeremy Harmon and Brad Slayton. Gentlemen, how are you?
Top notch, as always.
Sweet. Brad?
Let's hug it out, bitches.
A little bit later, we'll be joined by our special guest host for the evening, the CEO of the film production giant Modern Cine, and now the newest and most creative social media outlet, Ten Square, Mr. Andrew Vandenhouten. We'll get to him in a little bit. But first, well, we lost one of the greats this week. Robin Williams is the funniest man to ever live. This is not a debatable statement. You know what else he was? An amazing human, a great father, a legendary actor, but he was also a tortured man who battled addiction and depression. A few days ago, Mr. Williams can take no more and took his life. A sad day for not only his family and friends, but also the millions of fans and admirers whose lives he touched over the years. Tonight, we want to take a look back at the man who made the world laugh, cry, and laugh some more. So guys, what was your first memory of Robin Williams?
I'll shoot off the hip first. Since Michael and I are basically the same age, I think my first introduction to Robin Williams was probably the same as his, Brad. I don't know about you, but I was cognizant watching television at the time, Mork and Mindy came on. So his appearance on Happy Days as well as the Mork and Mindy show, I recall watching it with great interest at age four when it hit the airwaves. Really enjoyed it. The Big Egg always stole the show for me, and the Nanu Nanu and Shazbot and all that stuff. I didn't know what Shazbot meant at the time, but now I do, which is a pretty cool curse word. So that was my first introduction to Robin Williams.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with you. Mork and Mindy was the first time I ever got a chance to get to know him. Popeye again, which was, I was about six at the time when that came out. I believe that was maybe one of the first films my parents ever tried to take us to the movies for. I probably remember it as being such a great film. I've seen it over the years, and it's really not. But, you know, Robin's fantastic in it as usual, and it would be mine. Brad?
Yeah, it's Popeye for me. I mean, Mork and Mindy, I didn't catch until it was on Nick at Night, you know, when I guess I was like 10 or 11, because I mean, I'm 33, so yeah, it was already on Nick at Night. But yeah, it was Popeye, and I was like, oh my gosh, he's so cool, you know?
Definitely.
And then how are those arms that big? That was my first
Robin became a household name in Mork and Mindy, a character that still resonates with people today. Was it the lovable nature or the comedic aspects of Mork that made him so memorable, Jeremy?
Maybe a little bit of both. I mean, I remember it being very funny, and that's why I liked it. The lovable aspect, that was something that I paid much attention to when I was 4 years old. However, it made me laugh a lot. Even back then, probably so much of it went over my head that it didn't matter. But that he was able to make adults laugh as well as someone who was four, I think really is testament to the nature of how funny of a man he really was. Because I remember my father laughing, enjoying it as much as I did watching it. So I a little bit of both, but to me, it could probably be humor more on that end.
So to both of you, Robin's career took off with Mork and Mindy, but his film career really took off with The World According to Garp, where Robin actually showcased his talents to include not only his comedic persona, but also his dramatic style. So I kind of asked the question, why was this important, do you think, to Robin to branch out like this so early in his career when his career was so comedic driven before that?
Well, he was a Juilliard-trained actor. Like, he wasn't like a Rodney Dangerfield, you know, which, I mean, I love Rodney Dangerfield, but, I mean, he was a Juilliard-trained actor, you know, with Christopher Reeve. So, I mean, he was the shit, you know, when it came to actual acting, you know. I mean, he wasn't just this guy who had a funny sense of humor and could make people laugh. He he had talent. I think he got pigeonholed, you know, until he got more famous and could call the shots. So he was probably like, yeah, well, you know, it's like the people today do these passion projects, like these little micro-budget indie films, you know, and then they star in something like The Avengers.
Right.
I think that clearly Williams had demons well back when he was young. You know, he struggled with addiction and alcohol and with drugs and alcohol his whole life. And I think that he had that need for an outlet. And I think that the dramatic roles really gave him that opportunity, because if you look at the course of his career, the bulk of his roles that are dramatic are tortured souls, from What Dreams May Come to Awakenings to Dark. They all have that air to them, right? So they all veer in that direction. So I think perhaps it was just a way for him to cope with his own issues. And Brad said he's a Juilliard trained actor. Obviously, he's not going there for comedy's purpose. He's there to be a Shakespearean and be able to handle the heavy roles. And he did a great job. And you know, I compare him a lot to Bill Murray doing, you know, The World According to Garp, to Murray doing Razor's Edge, right?
Right.
Because you know, these are pretty fascinating guys. These are, you know, complicated guys. And, you know, while the comedy does provide a certain outlet, obviously there's a portion of their souls or their personas that they want to redirect and give another venue to shine. And those, I think those projects are just as important, because frankly, without The Razor's Edge, I don't think we would have gotten these later day Bill Murray roles, like Lost in Translation, like Rushmore, like his stuff with Jim Jarmusch, right? So I think that those are key for those types of actors to at least explore. And, you know, for someone like Adam Sandler, it didn't work just because he's bad.
Right.
But, you know, he's not on par with someone like Robin Williams or Bill Murray. So I think that it was key that he get those roles and make them work. And he did. I mean, Garp is one of my favorite movies of his, if not my favorite. I saw that at a very young age. I thought the role always touched me. There are parts of it that I didn't quite grasp, like the blowjob in the car scene and the guy getting his penis chopped off. But it's a tough one to realize years down the road after you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I saw that and didn't know it was happening. I think that it was a necessary portion of his evolution as an actor. And thank God he did it, because he gave Fisher King. I mean, it's hard to top that one.
Yeah. And I mean, right after Garp, it seemed to be like, I think Hollywood wanted to push him back into comedy a little bit. But a couple of years later, we got Good Morning Vietnam, which was his first gigantic hit and his first Oscar nomination, which, funnily enough, his next role a year and a half later was the iconic Dead Poets Society, which led to his second Oscar nomination. Interesting, because this led to a string of dramatic roles over the next course of 5 years. Do you think the nominations and the loss lit some sort of competitive fire under him?
I'm sure it did, but I think he was finally at a point to where he was like, hey, all these great roles are actually coming to me, and I'm an established name now, you know, to where he could do them. And as the awards came, like, he just seemed like he's one of those people that loved the craft. Like, I'm sure he was thrilled when he finally won an Oscar, but I think he was a true lover of the craft.
Yeah, but to me, like Jeremy mentioned earlier with The Fisher King, I mean, you're talking about literally three films within a 4-year period. He was nominated for 3 Oscars and lost 3 times. I mean, that's something that I think even Jim Kelly from the Buffalo Bills would say it's a tough one to swallow.
Yeah. Talk to Peter O'Toole about that. He went 9, 10, 12 times, something like that.
Yeah. I mean, for somebody, I think with somebody, I don't really want to bring it into the conversation too much tonight, but I wonder if the loss of not being, you know, being nominated and not being accepted was something that added a little bit to the depression and the issues that he was having during that time.
I don't know that I would agree with that. I mean, I think that I kind of put him in the same category as a Dustin Hoffman. I don't think that that kind of shit mattered to him, right? He was obviously very happy to win his Oscar for Good Will Hunting, and deservedly so. There were some really strong performances in that particular year, and I'd put it up there with the best of them. I just don't think that mattered. You know, I think that he was just happy to be doing what he was doing, right? He got paid to do what he loved to do, and I don't ever see him as a guy who'd maybe driven to get that award. I think what he was driven by, and is by getting great roles and being able to make them work. You know, I think that that's where his failure would have, if he felt like he didn't do a great job in a role, I feel like that would be what would have changed him in a mental state, right? Because this is what he lived and breathed. If it wasn't his comedy, it was his acting.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
No, I understand what you're saying. My question was more geared towards, I think, that time frame. And I think what you're going through like an uphill, that you're starting to reach that peak of your career, you start getting nominated for Oscars, life starts to kind of overwhelm you a little bit because of the whole Oscar buzz, all the other things are going on. And I think sometimes, I think it would lead people to, whether you don't want it or not, to be starting to smell yourself a little bit and saying, wait a second, what's going on here? I just got nominated once or twice or three times, and lost once or twice or three times. Like, what's going on?
See, like with the Fisher King, I think he did, I don't think he did the Fisher King for an Oscar. I think it was like, holy shit, I get to work with Terry Gilliam again.
And I don't think he did all. Yeah, I agree. I don't think he did any of the films for Oscars, but I think when you do get nominated, it's an honor.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just looking at the people that he lost to in the 3 years, 90, 88, 90, and 92, when he was nominated for the first three. So the first one he lost to Michael Douglas in Wall Street. So Hollywood royalty, that's probably a given. He was great in that. I think that there's probably plenty of people that would argue that Williams was better in Good Morning Vietnam. And if you look at 90, he was up against Daniel Day-Lewis in My Left Foot. I mean, it's hard to argue with that one. And then In 92, it was Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs. I mean, it was the last time that a film has taken every single award, major award, acting and directing and best picture. So, he's up against two lose situations. It didn't have a chance. And I mean, the Fisher King was the one that he probably had the best shot at, but he was up against, Dead Poets Society, excuse me. But he was up against Daniel Day-Lewis and what most people would probably think of his prototypical performance, right?
All right, fair enough.
Yeah. And we could discuss the debates of the Oscars and all that shit, whatever. Do I think it drove him? It probably did maybe drive him to a place where he wanted to do, these juicy roles, because seeing these guys get these great roles and there is some heat on him after that, and I'm sure that helped. And maybe he just wanted, good spots so he could get good money to do cocaine. I mean, at that point in time, he was, in a different world, we'll put it that way.
So the 90s were just series of amazing films, one after another. Do you have a standout film from this time period for him?
Used Cars.
Such a good movie.
I love that fucking movie. And Tim Robbins, him and Tim Robbins play off each other so fucking well.
Yeah, that's like, pretty awesome.
I don't know why it doesn't get more love. Like, I absolutely love Used Cars.
So you're talking in the 90s, boy. I would have to go with I've never been a Hook fan. I know that a lot of people are down with that one. That one's never been a big the Birdcage to me. He is so good. That's such a funny movie.
That's
a remake that works. I mean, having seen La Cage aux Folles, the original is fantastic, but that remakes are so bad in the grand scheme of it all. I really hate them on principle, but boy, he was superb in that movie.
Yeah.
Superb.
Brad, do you have one?
I snuck into that movie when, I guess I had to be 11 or 12. Like, I bought a ticket for a PG movie and snuck into it because of Robin Williams, and Gene Hackman, who they played off of each other amazing. I think I was the only straight person in that movie theater. Like, I had no clue what I was walking into, and I just left with, my jaw on the floor. Like, wow, this is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and it's hard to look past Fisher King. I mean, let's be honest with ourselves. That's a super amazing, fantastic movie.
True. I was a big fan of Toys, actually.
Oh, yeah.
I saw part of it once, and that was it.
Oh, go revisit it. It's such a great movie. And it's definitely one of those films that actually really encapsulated both his comedic and dramatic roles. And really, I think it offered him that just space and time to just play around, you know, in both worlds, and really gave him the opportunity to flourish, I think. And I think that some of his best roles, like Good Morning Vietnam, are the times where he flourishes in both comedic and dramatic role.
Well, I mean, even for people who aren't Disney fans like myself, like, you have to admit he's hilarious in Aladdin.
Oh, he's like, absolutely hilarious.
Like, I'm a hardcore anti-Disney person. And God, I love that movie. Like, he's...
Wow. I mean, that's jokes for the entire
family. Well, no, but I mean, that's something you can say. Like, so many of these kids' movies are so flippant stupid for adults. But you can watch Aladdin with your kids, and you laugh, and your kids might not be laughing. You know what I mean? Like, he brought some... Without him, that movie fails.
I agree. 100% with that. So,
okay, yeah.
Robin finally won the Oscar. Obviously, we all know this, 1998, for his role in Good Will Hunting. But the question lies that since he did win the Oscar in 98, was this his finest role to date?
No. No. I think that this one could probably be safely placed in the makeup Oscar for him. He was great in the movie, and I don't think that most people would argue with that. But it's nowhere near his best role.
So
all the ones he was nominated for were superior roles. I think his role in Garp was better. I have to admit, the last few years of his stuff I haven't seen. So it's hard for me to comment maybe on his last 5 to 10 years. He did do that. Didn't he do that biker movie with John Travolta and Tim Allen, which makes me kind of cringe.
So if I put a gun to your head and said, what is the best film that he made before, up to Good Will Hunting, what would your answer have been?
Well, if it hinges on his role as a major part of it, then I would have to say Fisher King or Garp. If it doesn't, then I'd have to go Deconstructing Harry, because I think his part in that is unreal. And I think that's one of the best Woody Allen movies of all time. But yeah, I can't argue with Fisher King or Garp as being his finest or the best movie he was in.
Brad, do you have one?
There's a lot of them that Singer looking through his IMDb now, trying to see if you're going before. I really have to. I mean, Adventures of Baron Munchausen, you know?
That's a great one. I was thinking about that one too, but I can't remember how much he was even in it.
He's not. Well, that's what I'm saying. You were saying like Deconstructing Harry. You know what I mean? Was Hamlet before? He did a great job in Hamlet.
Yeah, that was just before it.
You know, so yeah, and I mean, Good Will Hunting. Here we go. If anyone's ever listened to podcasts, I fucking hate Ben Affleck. So I just fast forwarded, and all I've ever seen of Good Will Hunting is the scenes that Robin Williams is in.
Yeah,
that's all I've ever watched.
I honestly have to go with Perry. I mean, I thought that the Fisher King was just. I think that when I go back in time and I think about, and I agree with you, Jeremy, about the Oscars. We don't have to go back into that, but I think that may be his role that will be always remembered for me, that he got robbed of. Like, it should have been like a 1-1A maybe that year. But he was also great as, like you said, the King of the Moon and Baron von Munchausen. I loved it. But from a comedic standpoint, just from a fun, just... I know it's not that popular, but I mean, I think he was just great as in Hook. I mean, I thought that was such a fun movie. And Jumanji. I mean, these were two fun, real enjoyable films that really just encapsulate him as the person that he really is, which is a person that just wants to have a good time. And I think that those two films stand out to me as just reminding me of who he was as a person, I think. So I'll ask the question, do you have a favorite role of his?
Yes. It's World's Greatest Dad. that's my favorite of any of his roles. Like, I absolutely adore that movie, which sadly, people, if you haven't seen it, watch it. It's on Netflix streaming. It takes on an eerie meaning now, which sucks because it's such a great film by Bobcat Goldthwait. And you know, with him and Robin Williams having been best friends for years, it's really sad that it takes on that meaning now. Not to ruin anything for the movie, but so many profound things. And the film, I mean, it's, I don't know if Bobcat's ever commented on it, but, you know, he toured with Nirvana for the In Utero tour and spent like hours with Kurt Cobain up all night and everything and discussions. It seems very thinly veiled as like a commentary on Kurt Cobain's death, like that movie. I mean, even to the point where Novoselic has a cameo in the film.
Hmm. Interesting.
And the initials of the kid are KC.
Hmm.
You know, it's a very odd movie. It really sucks because it's such a great film, and now it's going to be viewed with an asterisk.
Yeah.
You know, and that wasn't the intention. Right. You know, originally Robin Williams wasn't even going to play the role. Like, he approached Robin Williams and said, "Hey, can you be like the principal?" And Robin was like, "No, I want the lead," you know? So it wasn't in the writing. It wasn't some hidden knowledge or anything like that. But I watched it again last night and I'm like, God, this is amazing. And for the fact of him doing a nude scene, which is a little odd, but. You know, check it out if you want to see Robin Williams. That's
your thing.
World's Greatest Dad, if that's it. You know, he also, like, and it's weird, you know, because people always say, oh, Robin did this for me. Like, I'm a pretty hairy dude. Like, when I was, like, going through puberty, I saw Robin Williams with, like, gorilla hair on his arms. Like, that made me feel okay, you know? But you know what I mean? Like,
no, I do.
He's like a hairy
dude. I mean, I don't, like, but I do.
I'm like, okay, like, this... You know, you're like 12, 13, 14 going through puberty and shit. It's like, wow, you know, this guy's got tons of hair everywhere as well. Fine.
Yeah. Okay. You got to follow that up.
It's so hard to follow up Brad with his off the wall shit. I still think I would put Garp there, but I would also list his role in The Best of Times, which I don't know if too many people have seen that one. Him and Kurt Russell.
That son of a bitch.
Man, I really like that. And I
drop the damn ball in the end zone.
not in the final one though. I love that movie. I don't know why. It's just the redemptive quality that the guys get to go back and relive that one moment and are able to make it happen. I love when watching football at the dinner table and his wife gets mad at him. I think it just has a lot of qualities. His character mirrors my father in a couple of ways in that particular movie, and I appreciate that. So maybe not the role that most people would think. And I will say this, I do find it immensely amusing that he was in Shakes the Clown.
Oh, my God.
Smoochie?
And Smoochie is good, too. But if you guys haven't seen Shakes the Clown, gosh, do yourself a favor. It is brilliant. Another Bobcat Goldthwait masterpiece. It's just fantastic.
Adam Sandler's best film he's ever been in.
Yeah, I would actually agree with you on that.
Wow, I got to follow those up. I really, going dark, I really liked him in Insomnia. As Walter Finch. I thought that his performance in that film was eerie, actually, to me. And it really didn't remind me of Robin Williams. It just reminded me of... I think that was a weird dark period, 2002. He did 1 Hour Photo, Death to Smoochie, and Insomnia all in the same year. All three of those films are extremely the polar opposite of really Robin. But I think that the takeaway from what I'm trying to say is I love Robin as Robin, but I think when he gives you something a little bit more than what you expect, Sometimes it will surprise you, and Insomnia did surprise me a lot.
He does. He does. He did do Creepy very well. I never saw the final cut, but that, you know, 1 hour photo, I thought was a pretty underrated performance of his. An interesting little movie. Enjoyed it quite a bit, and he was creepy as all get out in that.
Oh, absolutely.
I think what he did with Insomnia, like, to me anyway, like, Pacino obviously was on the downslide, but I mean, he outacted circles around Pacino, you know?
No doubt.
And it's like, it made me, like, take up notice of, like, holy hell, he's putting, like, Pacino in the bullpen, you know? Like, it's kind of, yeah, because people think of Pacino as like the actor, you know, he's not, but I mean, he has that reputation, you know, and he kind of overpowers every film he's in, you know, regardless of the role.
So,
what an ass, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, for Robin Williams to kind of overshadow him in that, it's kind of amazing to think about, you know, for him to be the one that kind of, you know, puts the muzzle on Pacino for once.
So we're in the 2000s, and we can think of the fact that the series of hit or misses, mostly misses, engulfed basically the last 14 years of his life. Why do you think Robin abandoned drama for a return to comedy? Because that's basically what he did. The majority of his films went back to comedy.
Well, if you look at a lot of what he did, is family fare, right? So clearly he did a lot of his films for his kids, which I think makes sense, like Happy Feet and August Rush, which look like just a turd pile, and the Night at the Museum movies. I mean, all those have a family quality to them. So my guess is, while he wanted, well, maybe he didn't want to, but it just feels like to me that that's what he wanted to do. He just felt he wanted to create work that his kids could watch that they could enjoy together, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that was part of it.
I think that's a good answer. Brad, was there a role that you wish that Robin may have played? It either could be a role, like a return to a role, or something altogether new.
You know,
I'm putting you on the spot.
I would have liked to have seen him play a Nazi.
A Nazi?
You know, like in a drama. You know, something just purely and totally evil. You know, not like a horror film. But, you know, something like, I say Nazi as in like Christoph Waltz and Inglourious Basterds or Schindler's List. You know, something just totally evil to where, you know, not like a slasher or anything, but just something where you're, it's almost impossible. I guess it is impossible to hate Robin Williams. So I would have loved to have seen him in a role where you absolutely hate the character because, you know, we're mentioning 1 hour photo. He's just misguided. He's not a killer, you know. Insomnia, he's, you know, there's, they try and build compassion for him. So he never had that role where he's just 100% hated as a villain.
Sure.
A role that I wish he would have taken. Gosh, I don't know that I can answer that question because it's hard for me to think of one where, you know, maybe he could have taken over one of the roles that Morgan Freeman has taken as the wise old sage, right? Because I think, as a mentor in Good Will Hunting, I thought that role suited him very well. So if he were to play a Morgan Freeman type character in a movie, since Morgan Freeman just basically recycles the same role, maybe even in Seven. How about that? Or maybe he plays Kevin Spacey's character in Seven. What about that?
Oh, wow. That would, you know what? That would have been pretty awesome, I think.
Go ahead. No, I want you to go.
Oh, okay. I was going to mention the Riddler, you know, because it was always tied to him as the Riddler, you know, on all these internet rumors. I would have loved to have seen that. He could have definitely done better than Jim Carrey.
Hard-pressed to think that he wouldn't have been just out of this world when it came to playing a role like that. And, you know, and as I'm staring at my wall of movies over here, I see State and Main, the David Mamet movie, which if you haven't seen, is fantastic. He has Williams has anything to do with it. But if he would have worked with a guy like Mamet, who has that dialogue that just pops up the screen, you know, real rapid fire, I think it would have suited his cadence and the way he talked, especially when he was really got it going. I think that he and Mamet could have been a really good match for one another.
You think Scorsese could have gotten something different out of him?
Scorsese's a lazy fuck at this point in his life.
Well, let's put Scorsese in his prime. I mean, let's think about this. Could he have gotten something different than people have gotten out of Robin Williams before?
Well, I mean, if you think about the movies that he's made, so go back to Goodfellas, right? Which, you know, 1990, 91, whatever that was. I don't know that he's made a movie that Williams could have fit into. And it's not no knock on Williams as an actor, because I think he could have done most things. But I don't know how he fits into Casino.
The Departed?
Unless he plays the Don Rickles role or something like that. He could have done that.
How about the Joe Bob Briggs role?
Yeah. How did I know that was coming?
How about Jack Nicholson's role in The Departed?
No, I don't think he could have done that
one. No?
I mean, it would have been fun.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think he could have done it as well as Nicholson. He's crazy in a different way, right?
Yeah, he's crazy in a badass way.
Yeah, he's crazy in a I will fucking kill you way, whereas Williams is like a neurotic, happy, like he's like a happy drunk crazy, you know?
Yeah, he's like I'm going to sneak up from behind you and tickle you crazy.
Yeah,
you
know? Exactly.
Yeah.
I don't think he would have meshed well in that particular role with that film. So, I mean, it's hard for me to put him in a Scorsese movie outside of something like Casino, where you had all with Alan King and Don Rickles, those, you know, pillars of the, you know, the old comedy guard. He could have done something maybe like that.
Now, I think, you know, you mentioned Nicholson. I think Alexander Payne could have done something with him.
Yeah, I could see that.
You know, how he took Nicholson and Bruce Stern and all that. Give William. Williams 2 years ago, put him in like an artsy black and white film.
Yeah,
Jarmusch.
He made Reese Witherspoon tolerable in a movie. So
he did.
Did he?
No.
The Election. I mean, sure, character's an ass, and I would like to have punched her in the neck, but she was good. It's hard for me to admit that. By the way, yeah. It's the only time you'll hear me say that too.
I understand. How about Jarmusch?
Maybe. I think Jarmusch has like a, I'm not trying to open up the Jarmusch can here tonight. I think he has a set type to operate with. Like there's, you can tell it's a Jarmusch film. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Like, I don't know if
Robin fits into that.
It got to the point with Robin Williams, like, sadly, like you were saying, with the comedy and then the drama, like, it was the same types of drama characters, you know, which were, I mean, little, you know, changes, but they were the stock drama characters, where Jarmusch isn't stock anything, you know? So
how will each of you remember Robin?
The Birdcage is how I will remember him, because I think that is the microcosm of what he was as an actor to me, because there are some really, I think, fantastic dramatic scenes in that particular movie, but he's able to carry it with the comedy, and it's just such a perfect blend of all of it. So that's what it will always remind me of. That or him maybe doing comic relief with Billy Crystal and Whoopi Goldberg on HBO when I was a kid as well. Because I was always, I got the dirty end of it there, right? I got to hear the dirty part of comedians at that point in time, which was nice. Because everything was way too clean on TV. I preferred the fucks and the shits and the bitches and all that stuff, even at age 5. Mm. So I think those are two spots.
Brad, do you have one?
Yeah, it's seeing him live. In concert. That was second greatest comedian I've ever seen live. Just absolutely awe-inspiring and amazing.
When did you see it?
The 2002 tour, you know, where he came back like tickets, it's a big story. Anyways, we didn't have the money, me and my wife, for you. We weren't even married. We were dating. I was working like a shitty part-time job at a grocery store. I was like, fuck Robin Williams. It sold out like in 2 seconds, you know? So go and buy a lottery ticket, win like $800 on a scratch off, call the ticket scalper and pay $500 for like third row seats to Robin Williams. So
you really won $800 on a scratch off?
Yeah, that night we bought tickets to Robin Williams and Vanilla Ice.
God.
Jesus Christ.
They weren't together. They weren't together.
He would have punched you if he had known that.
God. He would have, absolutely.
Yeah, but no, I mean, serious, just awe-inspiring, like, amazing, connect, live energy. Like, there's nothing like seeing him bounce on the stage. But, I mean, not, obviously, no respect, disrespect to Robin Williams. I mean, Carlin was the greatest I ever saw. But
it's hard. It'd be hard to argue with
that. I mean, but yes, Robin Williams, a close, like, 1B, number 2.
I saw Kinison live on my 16th birthday.
Oh, my God.
That was pretty amazing.
I would bow to you for that.
Yeah, my dad won tickets on the radio by imitating Samson, yelling. It was awesome.
I have to hear that.
He's spot on, let me tell you.
I think I'm going to remember him by Robin Williams live at the Met with the last thing that he said when he said, talking to his son, and he's like, no, you're scared. And he says, nah, fuck it. I think to me, that just barely tells everything about the man at that point in time. It was fly by the seat of your pants. Don't give a shit. Let's just get this done. And, you know, he's definitely something that I'm going to remember forever. Now, Robin Williams will be sorely missed. I hope that he has found some peace that has eluded him for so long. Our thoughts and prayers go out to the Williams family and his friends during this time of mourning. We also lost another amazing member of the Hollywood community, Lauren Bacall, an absolute legend. And Jeremy would like to say a few words about her.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. It's been a tough week for people who like movies and acting and humor and all things that Hollywood, at least the good part of Hollywood, kind of represents. I mean, Bacall is not. Her passing is not the same tragedy that Williams is. She was 89. She lived a very long life. She worked the entire time. She was in the middle of filming a new noir film, which is a shame because I would have loved to have seen it, called Trouble Is My Business. Hopefully we'll get to see some of it at some point in time. But, you know, she's, you know, married to Humphrey Bogart, was with him in the three fantastically iconic movies, To Have and To Have Not, the adaptation of the Ernest Hemingway novel, The Big Sleep, which is probably the prototypical noir from 1944, and then Key Largo, another great film I believe Howard Hawks directed. She was as close to a queen of Hollywood as probably there ever was. I always appreciated her political activism. We had very similar political views. She was a charitable woman. She took, in her later days, she took some pretty chancy roles. And you know, I will point to the Lars von Trier films that she did, Dogville and Manderley. She was amazing to watch. She was gorgeous. She had a voice that you can never, ever forget once you've heard it. It's a shame. I mean, obviously she was 89, so she had a long, good life. She was married to two great guys, Jason Robards and Humphrey Bogart. She had good kids, and you know, she's one of the last of the old Hollywood guard that was left. So as we inch closer to the days when the old studio system is fading from existence, it's sad to see them go. So to Ms. Bacall and her family, friends, and the Hollywood community, it's a shame. It is a shame. I wrote a blog post on my blog about her and Williams passing, and you know, like I said, the In Memoriam video at the Oscars is going to be so big and so full of people, that's hard to say goodbye to. It's a tough year so far.
Yeah, and definitely two people in 2 days that have left a lasting impact on not only on the film and Broadway community, but also on millions and millions of people worldwide. So we're going to bring in our special guest for the evening, the CEO of the production film company giant modern cine and the newest and most creative social media outlet, Ten Square, Mr. Andrew Vandenhouten. What's up, Andrew?
Michael Petrelli, I'm honored to be on the show with you this evening, sir. And as we're both gigantic fanboys, it is truly a historical moment that we're sharing the radio waves via podcast this evening.
Yeah. And we have to have the buffer of this greatness, Brad Slayton, on to just keep us together, I think, to keep that nook together.
I like to buffer things. That's my talent.
He's a buffer.
I'm a buffer. Fluffer, buffer. Hey. Buffer, fluffer.
So well, before...
He did make a film called Hardwood. So
he did.
Starring Scott Hodges, people.
Well, before we jump into the topic, since our topic of the evening is a tribute to Robin Williams, I was wondering if you had any thoughts on the man while we sit here and bask in his greatness.
No, I just, you know, there was an acquaintance from college that did 1 hour photo. He directed it for Emerson College, and I remember him saying that he was like one of the biggest, amazing, most amazing opportunities of his career was to actually go ahead and direct Robin Williams in this project. And, you know, I personally have been, a fan. I mean, obviously Mindy Moore and like the comedy that he did over the years, stand up in addition to the actual performances on screen, comedic and otherwise, have just been like, you know, cornerstones of kind of my childhood. And you know, to watch him kind of, attract the next generation, you know, of kids, whether it was Jumanji or whatever. I mean, he's been part of the youth culture, I think, since we were younger and you know, all the way through now. And it's pretty crazy because, you know, if you look at Whoopi Goldberg and Billy Crystal and, you know, the work they all did together, they did a lot of amazing things using comedy, obviously. And so it's a pretty depressing week, I think, for America when you lose such an American icon like Robin Williams. And there's nobody like him, I don't think, you know, that's kind of filled anyone's, you know, certainly not his shoes. And I don't think that he's just so unique, you know, I don't think there's anyone who's done quite what he did.
Yeah. So I wanted to take some time to grill you. I mean, I interview you, my friend, and get inside your brain to discuss some of modern cine. But first, I wanted to talk to you about Ten Square. So yeah. What is Ten Square?
So Ten Square is the first crowd-powered social network and entertainment studio, and that we're actually letting our members vote on the actual stories that we produce. From their inception. So we'll hire a writer and, you know, for example, we hired the McManus brothers to write our first short film. They had a film called Funeral Kings that you can get on Netflix that was at South by Southwest a couple years ago. And so they presented our members with various story options and our members would vote on different story elements, character elements as they were writing their screenplay. So it was almost like choose your own adventure. You know, here are five options. Which do you want to see and which path do you want to go down? And so we took the popular vote on each option, and that was kind of how the script got written, is on that user feedback. And so that was the first part of the process. Then we had a director competition, which we had 27 directors throw their hat in the ring and basically put up, you know, reels of their work for round one. And each of these competitions that we do, whether it's for directors, actors, cinematographers, they're three-round competitions, and, you know, we basically let our members always in round one vote on, if not all, the majority of contestants trying to get into, you know, the role that we're looking to hire. So we started with directors. JP Ladd from Fort Lee, New Jersey, was the winner of the director competition. He did On the Lot. There was a competition years ago called On the Lot, and he had competed in that and made it, you know, fairly deep into the process. So when we actually got him in our competition and he won, I wasn't surprised. His work was really, really strong. And he really had a decent amount of fans. I mean, a lot of members voting for him. And so JP is awesome. He's psyched, and he's going to be directing this movie that everyone voted the name on. There were seven titles or eight titles, and everyone voted on While You Were in a Coma. So JP Ladd from Fort Lee, New Jersey, directing the McManus comedy, dark comedy, While You Were in a Coma. And then we crowdsourced our actors. We had like 57, I think it was about 57, it was either 59 or 57 actors submit and compete in the actor competition to be a lead actor in the film. And we hired the winner who won, got hired by us, and his name is James St. Vincent. And, you know, he's very appropriate for the film, which was actually great because when it's out of our hands as producers, it's there's kind of a bit of a, you know, we got a little anxious to see, it was the first time doing it, to see if it will work, and it certainly did. And so James St. Vincent is from New York, and he lives in the Bronx, and he's going to be coming out. We're shooting the film in El Paso, Texas, actually. That's the news, and we start shooting on the 5th. We haven't announced that anywhere, so that's you're getting the scoop first. Yep, it's a four to five day shoot, and we're shooting in El Paso. The cinematographer who won the competition's from Los Angeles. There were 8 cinematographers competing, and of those 8, David Klazin ended up winning. And David has an extensive background doing like industrials, commercials, not as much narrative stuff out of the gate quite yet, but his competition submission videos. In round 2 and certainly in round 3 show his ability to actually shoot narrative, and the members also agreed with that, so he's moving onwards. And then we had we have a song competition going on now. We had 16 musicians submit and bands submit songs to have songs placed in the film, and the top 5 are writing original songs right now for the final round of the competition, and people will be able to vote on those songs in another week or so, 7 days from now. And so it's exciting, like crowdsourcing all of this stuff. I mean, there are judges that are involved in each of the competitions, and they do get to weigh in at certain points throughout the competition, whether it's being able to save a small percentage of the members in round 1, being able to actually select the members who go on to round three from the second round. The judges really are there, but ultimately it is the members' decision in the third round who ends up winning the various roles on our creative projects. And so I'm very excited about kind of Ten Square's ability to take user-generated input and place that into the actual development process. And so Ten Square is really, really going to be fun to watch when we get into other, you know, feature films. It'll kind of like be like Project Greenlight on steroids is like how I like to describe it to some degree. But then we do have this incredible social networking aspect of it as well. And that's cool because, like, unlike Facebook or LinkedIn, which are really, really focused on, you know, more, I would say certainly with Facebook, it's more, friends and family, and it's less about networking for business. And LinkedIn is way too corporate as far as I'm concerned. So what we're trying to do with Ten Square is really establish a creative base of members that are going to be part of our social network. And, of course, hardcore fans of film or people who like entertainment, like, of course, we want them in our community. And we think that by giving opportunities to anyone all over the country to become part of real professional projects is doing something that no studio in Hollywood or New York really would do. In that, like, we're flipping the paradigm. So, you know, instead of the people at the top of the pyramid actually making all the decisions, we're really letting it be more of a democratic process.
So talk me through a submission. I want to enter as a director, say. How do I go about entering myself into the contest?
So first thing you would do is go to tentsquare.com, which is tent, TENTSQUARE.com, short for content. So a place where people gather to create content, tentsquare.com. And you would sign up for an account using your Facebook sign-in, which pulls from your Facebook account all of the photo and the login information. Or you can just go ahead and sign up by filling out your name and email address and accepting our terms of use. And the next step is to go to projects and see what projects are happening, and then clicking on any competitions that might be open at the time. And then the submission process is pretty straightforward. If you're a director, round 1, at least in this particular competition, you submitted a reel of your work. And it could be anywhere from 60 seconds to 3 minutes long. If you were a singer-songwriter, it was a matter of submitting an original song for round 1. It's very, very user friendly. So when you get on there, you just click away and, you know, upload your video. We are making improvements on our video uploading process every day. We're working on improving our ability to flow things through as easy as possible for our members.
So you mentioned the voting, and I have a question about that. Are there only certain members can vote, or can anybody on the site submit to vote?
So any member can vote, and it's free to sign up. So even if you're just going on to support a friend of yours who's in a competition, all you got to do is sign up for free and you can vote once, and, you know, that's it.
So there's no waiting period or grace period, or you have to do a certain amount of things before you can add your voice.
That's correct. I mean, we really wanted to open it up and encourage people to get their friends and family and anyone they believe that would support them to come out and join our community and be part of it. You know, again, like, you can vote once every 24 hours in competitions. So that was the key thing. I mean, for me and from our perspective, I think the weight of votes, we wanted to make an equal weight across the board for everyone. You know, in the end, it's going to be a powers by number thing ultimately. So we want to build our community out as big as we can.
So what's the length of the competitions, like round ones, two, threes? Is it like a week or 2 weeks, or is it?
Yeah, so it's a good question. So every competition does vary a little bit. For our first project, for While You Were in a Coma, the screenplay development actually took place from between March 9th and June 11th.
Wow.
And anyone who voted during March 9th or June 11th on any of the actual story points that the McManus brothers were presenting would basically get they basically had the opportunity to, you know, it's like a ballot. Every time you vote, you would get a ballot in the sweepstakes. And that went for the director competition, actor competition. Every time you vote, you get a ballot. And one of those winners in this 10 square competition would actually become an executive producer on the project, and they're picked randomly. And features, they'll get to share in the profit. So passive, you know, participants who aren't creative necessarily but have an opinion and want to vote can actually become part of a film as an executive producer, which is cool. So coming back to your question, though, the director competition started on April 24th and it ended on June 11th. And so it was it's a decent amount of time for the whole process to happen. The round one process started on April 14th and it ended on May 2nd. So the directors had about 10 days to submit their reels, and then members had 8 days to vote, and then the top three directors were announced. Round two for the director submission was an 8-day process where directors were asked questions by our judges, and then they went ahead and submitted their answers in a video response, and they had 8 days for the members and judges to select the finalists. Two directors were selected on May 19th. Then we had a 14-day period wherein directors submitted a scene from the film. So the top two directors had to actually go out and direct and produce a scene of the film. And the members had 7 days after the 2-week period that the directors had to create that video to actually vote on it. They had 7 days. So that was the director process. And each competition varies. I mean, it's a little different for every competition because the requirements and what we're vetting require either more or less depending on what we're looking for.
So winners are winners. Is there anything for the runner-ups?
Well, that's interesting. I'm glad you asked that question. So we believe that our community is incredibly talented and that we really want to incorporate as, you know, everyone, if not everyone, almost everyone on our projects will be a 10 Square member, ideally. And so we went ahead and actually hired Marcel Bowman, who was a runner-up in the actual actor competition. She actually is going to be getting hired, as is the second runner-up, Sydney Pyrick. She's going to be hired for something which we haven't announced yet. Austin Savage got hired, actually, for While You Were in a Coma, and Casey Lee Dickerson got hired, too. So all of our finalists actually got roles in the movie and or another project. So the answer is, yeah, even if you don't win the lead role, you could get hired for other things. A lot of the directors that didn't win in the 10 Square Challenge were in the process of discussing and developing various projects that we're going to do through 10 Square as well.
So everyone's really a winner in this.
Yeah, I mean, if you're talented, if you're great and you stand out, like, there's a really good chance that you could get picked for something. And if not by us, you know, our community is chock full of producers and directors and creatives. So we'd like to think that our community will eventually start really actively, you know, bringing people in into the process as well, you know, or picking people out of the process, I should say.
So do you have a competition coming up now, or are we in the lull period?
So, yeah, we're dealing with the song competition. So we're in the third round of the song competition. In 7 days and 1 hour, we're going to have 5 videos that'll post that are all original songs being sung by our top 5 singer-songwriter bands. And then members will have 4 days to vote on their favorite songs. And then one of those songs will get placed in the film While You Were in a Coma.
So where can everybody sign up for this amazing site?
So 10square.com. Again, it's TENTSQUARE.com, 10square.com.
Now, I'm going to pick your brain regarding your other passion, modern cine.
Yep.
So you've created some pretty intense films over the years. How do you go about picking which products you choose to pursue?
For me, a project really has to have two things that are incredibly important. One is story, and one is you know, the ability to tell that story within a world that I know I can afford to produce it in. So it's pretty straightforward. If there's a great story and it's something that I feel I can put the resources together on and I can do within the world of what we do, I usually am very interested. How do I pick a project? I mean, again, we don't take unsolicited, script submissions, generally speaking. However, for Jugface and for Headspace, they were incredibly unsolicited, and we ended up making two great films, from those. You know, these days we're trying to really pick, projects that come through references or people that we know within the community that we like and think their work is really strong. Unlike Tent Square, where we're really trying to democratize the process of making films, Modern Cine runs more like a traditional production company. And so obviously, there's a vetting process and we choose every project we make.
So what was the most challenging film you faced getting an audience for?
I think doing Jack Ketchum's The Girl Next Door was incredibly challenging because you're dealing with subject matter that's highly taboo, and it was based on a true story, of course. Whenever you're dealing with children and you're dealing with a very rough subject like child abuse, you have a lot of ethics questions that come into play. You want to make sure your production is safe. You want to make sure your actors and the kids know what you're actually dealing with. You don't want to put yourself in a situation wherein you're, just kind of willy-nilly going for it and just shooting it from the hip. You got to actually plan everything out, hire the right people. And this goes for any project, but that particularly, you never want to hire young actors that are not
ready for something like that. Yeah.
Aware or understanding of the material. So, yeah.
So you've released quite a few films this year, including All Cheerleaders Must Die, and Jugface.
Everyone has to.
Yeah. So you've gotten positive critical acclaim from both of these films. Do you look at 2014 as a breakout year for the company?
I do and I don't. In many ways, I feel like Cheerleaders is our biggest film and it's our most commercial film. So in that regard, I absolutely feel like it was at opening Midnight Madness, which is an incredible honor thanks to Colin Geddes and his support and the Toronto support from TIFF for the film. There's no doubt our brand is even more, on the tips of people's tongues. That being said, I feel like, Headspace got us a lot of attention. That was our first film. The Girl Next Door got us to Deauville and, got us a bunch of attention. So I feel like we've been very, very blessed and lucky to make these movies that get a lot of attention early on. I will say that, The Woman for me was a huge turning point for our company, and that I feel like Lucky McKee elevated the level of direction that our company kind of had been working within. And not to say that Greg Wilson didn't either. Greg absolutely elevated it too. But what Lucky definitely did was he made a film that got into Sundance, and he made a film that, had a lot of humor in it. And for our company to have a film with a lot of humor in it was a very unique thing, I think. And so that humor in the genre really opened up our company a bit. So when we got to Cheerleaders, it made more sense. And of course, with Jugface, we took a little bit of a step back with humor, but a very large step forward with originality. I think that screenplay and that concept is probably one of the most original projects that our company's been involved with.
Yeah, I actually found you guys through The Woman, and it was one of those films that I found through Sundance, and it was just an amazing film at the beginning when I first saw it, and it led me to all these other great projects that you guys have been involved in. And I'm on my way to watch Jugface, and I can't wait. It's one of those films that's been sitting in my Netflix queue, and I've been dying to watch it. I've heard so many fantastic things about it. So what is the most successful avenue for your films? Is it VOD? Is it Netflix? Theater? What is it?
As far as our movies being seen, I would say they're most successfully seen illegally by people who watch them online, which is unfortunate. I find millions of views of our movies all over the world that are unpaid for, and obviously people are watching our work. So that is, probably the most successful viewing perspective from a financial business perspective. You know, I'd say streaming video on demand and television have been our strongest kind of, you know, our strongest marketplaces for the product that we make. And then I would say, as far as cachet and audience awareness within the more film-centric world, absolutely film festivals, and probably as a platform, Netflix, which is an SVOD platform as well.
Right. Any interesting projects coming down the line that you can give us a few words on?
There's a wonderful book series that I think everyone should read and start reading called The Undertakers. And it's written by a writer named Ty Drago. And it's phenomenal. It's fun. The creator of Final Destination, Jeffrey Reddick, wrote the screenplay based on the first book. It's a 5-book series. 3 of the 5 books have come out. And it's the first book I've ever read where I can kind of say, you know, confidently that I can say confidently, not I can kind of say, I can definitely say that for young adults, it is a true genre movie. And it's a true genre movie that young adults can watch, whether they're 12, 11, 13, like it's going to be that kind of project. And I think for me to be able to do something for a younger audience in the genre is very exciting.
Awesome. Any release date, or are we just in the early stages?
So we're in the early stages. It's a much bigger, I mean, it truly is like a YA franchise, and it's definitely more of a studio movie and a theatrical movie than the films we've been making. So, you know, it's been taking a little longer to put together. But that being said, we've had incredible movement on the project in the last couple months, and we've been able to get some very exciting interest from, in fact, an attachment. I can't say who it is, but I can say there's an attachment to the project that's significant enough that it's going to draw in, I think, the right director for the film.
Well, you know that Brad and myself are huge fans of your product and your company, and we wish you nothing but success, not only with Modern Cine, but with the amazingly innovative Tent Square, which is an awesome avenue for anyone trying to make it into the show business. Andrew, you've created 2 great things. Thank you so much for coming on, and we hope to bring you back soon.
Dude, I'd be honored to come back soon. And again, you know, for your listeners, you know, I can't tell them how much I appreciate the fact that, you know, they're willing to take the twisted ride that we've been bringing people on with Modern Cine. And if they haven't been on the bandwagon, you know, jump on board. You can watch most of our films are all on Netflix at this point, whether it's The Woman, The Girl Next Door, Funeral Kings, which is actually an edgy comedy by the McManus brothers, All Cheerleaders Die, and Jugface. You can watch them all on Netflix. If you don't know our company, go to Netflix and look up some of our films. And Michael, until next time, thank you so much for bringing me on, brother.
All right, we'll talk soon.
All right, take care, guys. Good night.
So that's all we have for this evening. Make sure you check out realnewsdaily.com for all your updates on news and reviews. Make sure you check out every movie from Modern Cine and register at Tent Square and spread the word about these amazing ventures. Andrew, thanks again. Jeremy and Brad, always a pleasure. I am Michael. See you next week. Good night, guys.
Good night.